This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hello, I'm Heather Brown, sitting in for Lisa Christensen. Welcome to the Between the Covers podcast. This week, we continue with The Stone Carvers by Jane Urquhart. Part of the fascination of this novel is its ability to travel in time. At one moment, we find ourselves in the late 1800s in Ontario, where a young man named Joseph Becker becomes entangled in Father Justier's plans for a Corpus Christi procession. Move ahead two generations, and we witness Joseph's granddaughter, Clara, have an encounter with young Eamon O'Sullivan that shakes both of them out of their childhood friendship. In this episode, Eamon comes calling, and Clara's brother Tillman sets off on his own lonely path.
The days lengthened. The snow began to melt, disclosing rough patches of the dark earth that had been ploughed the previous autumn after the harvest. And still, each evening, silent Irish climbed the hill towards Clara's kitchen. By now, Clara was in a blistering, tight-lipped rage whenever Eamon was in her presence, and much of the time that he wasn't. "He's courting you," her quiet, somber father told her with an uncharacteristic wink. "I'm not interested in being courted by the likes of him," Clara snapped, her face filling with color. "I'm not interested in being courted." Dieter Becker shrugged his shoulders as if it mattered to him not at all. But the next clear, bright evening, after Eamon's arrival, even before the boy had seated himself in his customary place, the older man excused himself and walked out to the barn. Clara had her back to the door, was lowering a tall stack of plates into the warm suds of the dishpan when she felt the whole atmosphere change by the fact they were alone together. She stared hard at the two skimpy lilac bushes she had planted last fall in the yard. Knowing she was never going to be able to turn around, she could feel Eamon's gaze touch her like a warm hand between her shoulder blades. If she could manage to turn around, she decided, if she could just manage to do that, then she would be able to see things as they were. Everything in place in her kitchen, a mat by the door, a damp tea towel thrown over a chair, all the reassuring furniture of her life undisturbed by his presence in her world. The low sun, fiercely brilliant in the center of the window pane, was making her eyes fill with water. It was becoming almost impossible to continue to scrutinize the yard. She turned finally, her hands glistening, drops of water clinging to the ends of her fingers. The room was dark in contrast to the brightness beyond the glass. Eamon was merely a featureless shape on a chair near the stove. Clara's intention was to cross the room and leave by the woodshed door, leaving him alone in the kitchen with his silence and his stubbornness. But she paused for a moment while her eyes adjusted to the shadows in the twilight room. After she had taken two or three steps, Eamon leaned forward and grasped her damp wrist. This one simple touch freed the storm of speech that had been building in her mind for weeks, setting in motion a savage interrogation. She hurled the words, almost hysterically, into the air. "What do you want? What right do you have? What are you doing here? And why don't you speak? What makes you think anyone wants you to come here?" He was still holding onto her wrist. He said nothing. They remained locked like this, obdurate, combatant, for several moments until Eamon flushed and tossed Clara's arm back toward her body as if it were a broken branch he were removing from his path. Then he was out of the chair. "And what is it you would have me say?" he asked, his voice half broken by anger and sorrow. "What can I possibly say to you?" He swung toward the door she had been planning to exit from, stopped as if he might have added one more word to his own question, then strode through the woodshed and out across the damp snow in the yard, his head down, his hands thrust in his pockets. The shaft of setting sun that had so troubled Clara's eyes was now on the chair where Eamon had been sitting. He had forgotten his jacket. Clara's arm remained near her stomach, where it had come to rest after Eamon released it. It looked like a foreign object to her, something that was not now and had never been connected to her body. She watched with some interest as color gradually returned to the white marks his fingers had left on her skin. Eamon didn't walk up to the farm the next night, or the night after that, or in the weeks that followed. Thankfully, with the lengthening days, her father became too busy in the fields after supper to ask about the boy, and Clara herself had her sewing to attend to. But now it was as if she were always waiting for something, or worse, as if she were searching for something she could barely remember. All those who were gone from her life haunted her, but imprecisely, never really materializing into mother or lost friend or brother. Young Tilman Becker knew about pathmasters, had seen men working at maintenance, and had been told by his father about earlier days when the trees were felled and the stumps removed. But he could almost believe that roads were natural phenomena like rivers or forests. He feared the disappearance of them due to lack of use, could imagine roads vague with weeds, then lost forever in the texture of woods and meadows. As a much younger child, he had been made aware of this possibility when a path he had beaten from the house to the creek filled in with wildflowers during a late spring week when his parents had succeeded in convincing him to go to school. This had terrified him so much that his sleep had suffered, and he had woken with a start far too early each morning, rousing the rest of the house with a shrill, relieved announcement that the lane that ran from the yard to the concession line was still there, had not been erased during the night. School had been impossible for Tilman. He could not learn to read or write or even how to remain in his seat. The white marks on the blackboard frightened him, as did the fact that the desks were bolted to the floor. No one, nothing could make him stay, neither the schoolmaster's switch nor his father's harsh words. The appearance of the truant officer had seemed to his parents to precipitate his first full-blown departure. But it was really the sight of migrating birds sweeping across the sky and the low angle of the silver October light that had caused him to leave, though no one would ever know that for certain but himself. That first time he had moved south as if by instinct, had slept shivering in barns on the edges of Ontario towns named after great European cities, London, Brussels, Paris, and eventually on the outskirts of villages that wore the names of spas or palaces, Leamington, Blenheim. At times, like an animal on the verge of hibernation, he would sleep for 2 or 3 days. But finally hunger would awaken him and drive him toward the more industrial centers of Woodstock or Chatham and the bins of garbage stored behind brick hotels filled with commercial travelers. Once, responding to his angelic face, his tattered clothing, and his almost ethereal thinness, a woman crossed the street and handed him a basket of groceries without saying one word. He feasted for days, delighted by his luck. But if anyone questioned him, asked where he came from, where he was going, or what he was doing, he would disappear before they finished speaking, making certain to turn a corner or slip into a woodlot so they could no longer see him. He received comfort, warmth, and information from animals, from the horses and cows with whom he often slept, and from the great congregations of birds whose numbers multiplied as he moved deeper into the southern part of the province. The honking clamor, the panting noise made by beating wings, had pulled him down the flat, dusty roads of Essex County until the birds abandoned him in the marshlands on the edge of Lake Erie. There he stood, weeping among bulrushes as tall as himself, while flock after flock set out across an expanse of water that stretched as far as the horizon. Tilman had returned, at the end of this first journey, to a home that was somber under a weight of grief. The search parties having given up in despair 2 weeks previously, his mother, father, and sister dressed in black. Dieter had whipped him then, for the first and the last time, but in a half-hearted way, the act really being an expression of relief. That winter, Tilman taught himself how to read by making use of the pictures and captions in a butler's Lives of the Saints, and each day he walked back and forth to his grandfather's farm in the old man's workshop, where occasionally he could be coaxed into mastering some basic carving technique. It seemed to his parents that with these efforts at self-education, he had begun to settle. It was his mother who had sensed that he would someday leave forever, and that his disappearance would take place in the autumn, during the same hunting season when he had been conceived. Helga knew she couldn't bear to lose him. When he was home, she would rise sometimes 6 or 7 times in the night to check his room. At the table, noon and supper time, her face drawn with exhaustion, she would often threaten him with unspecified punishments were he to go missing again. As the summer progressed, she insisted he should not leave the yard, then the house, and eventually she tried to confine him to whatever room she happened to be in. When Dieter began the autumn plowing, he encouraged the boy to accompany him to the fields. This Tillman did for a while, walking beside the slow, stately procession of the 4 large, dignified workhorses. His distressed mother, watching this from the kitchen window, had the premonition that when the last furrow was finished, the boy would be gone. The grandfather had failed to interest him in any carving projects. He had grown even more silent at the table, and had taken to looking early in the morning out the south windows of the rarely used parlor, as if there was something there calling to him, something that no one else could see. The birds arrived suddenly and in great clamorous numbers, descending like dark rain into distant ponds, or sailing noisily overhead like storm clouds moving in a strong wind. Helga panicked and locked the door of Tillman's room one morning while he was still sleeping. But he escaped by the window, how she never knew, and appeared as usual at breakfast without a word to her about what had taken place. Later that day she took the boy's measurements to the blacksmith and returned with a hinged iron harness attached to a long iron chain. She wept and pleaded until her husband brought a cot to the woodshed. Then she stood beside him while he nailed the chain to the door jamb. "Only," she said, "until winter comes, only until then." "The boy will not submit to it," Dieter said. "He will not put it on." "I can't lose him." Helga turned from her husband and ran her fingers almost tenderly along the iron links. "I won't permit that to happen. You must force him to put it on." "And how am I to do that?" Dieter and Helga stood face to face, he breathing quickly, wanting to escape to his fields, she looking past his shoulder at the horizon that had so often enticed her son. Each hated the other and themselves for their part in Tillman's confinement. "You're bigger than he is," Helga said finally. When Clara had been sent to bed in her room upstairs, after a supper filled with a silence so profound that she would recall it later as a fifth person at the table, Dieter coaxed his son into the woodshed. Golden light from the kitchen lamps entered through the connecting door, and silver light from the partial moon shone through one cloudy window. "You're to sleep here now," he said to the boy. Only the foot of the cot was visible in the block of light entering from the kitchen. "You'll be our guard," he explained, "for foxes in the henhouse." Tillman was pleased by the proximity of the outdoors. "I like to sleep here," he said. His father did not answer, but left the connecting door slightly ajar when he walked back into the kitchen. A dreaming child is like a weed under water, each limb languid, heavy beneath the depth of sleep. Dieter was able to position and then close the harness around Tillman's frail ribs and shoulders without disturbing his rest. Only once, with the sound of the lock clicking shut, did his eyes fly open. But he was not really awake, and the lids lowered again 1 second later. The next morning, however, everyone in the house was hurled into consciousness by the terrible sound of Tillman's howls as he flung himself to the end of his chain again and again. Around him, his own dog ran in large, free circles, barking and snapping as if the boy were already a stranger in the yard.
That was Nikki Guadagni reading episode 3 of The Stone Carvers by Jane Urquhart. Next, Clara faces a difficult decision. The novel is published by Viking Press. This reading was produced by Alison Moss. You can subscribe to this podcast at cbc.ca/podcasting.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.